Thanks for this very nice introduction, which is not deserved, I think. But I was very happy to be here, so I thank you very warmly for inviting me here. I had a great year. So this is the job I've been doing when I was here, and you've got two different titles. This one was the original title which I submitted last year, and I have in mind to focus on three texts, or rather a series of fragments, and that was too much to kind of figure. So I decided to focus on one of the three texts. So this is the result is this. I've written a paper, which I would never think of reading to you. That would be an ordeal for both you and I. So it was better to prepare very simplistic slides. And so I'm going to show them. And just when the time is over, I will stop, because there is no interesting conclusion to this one. It's more describing the material and giving examples of what it's about. So this is the roadmap. I'll try to be very fast, because the web corpus has been introduced by Fabrizio Pregadillo and Licia Di Giacinto last year on an occasion of a reading session or lecture, perhaps. So perhaps some of you already know. I will discuss the title and the meaning of the title of this text, try to give basic information on the date and the authorship. Textual history is meant to be a very fast survey, otherwise it would take hours. And then sources of the reconstructed text, the edition which we have today, again, very simply. Then more descriptive, the sequence of the reconstructed text, how each item follow one another. And then more in detail, we'll examine the morphology of each item. Item here means fragment. I will explain this in a moment. The nomenclature of fragments, because some of them, they seem to have different functions and morphologies. And then if we have time, an analysis of the themes which are developed and the dominating themes, how observations and extrapolations come together in these texts, and concluding remarks probably will be skipped anyway. So how to define this corpus of texts from which this particular text comes? It's known in English as a web text, which is a translation of the Chinese word. We've got the character here. And it's also known as Confucian Apocrypha, or simply Apocrypha, because there is this early story that it was the secret classics written by Confucius in addition to the mainstream or official classics. So you can find both translations in secondary sources nowadays. Definitions now, it's very interesting, because I knew the second definition for a very long time, and recently Fabrizio Pregadillo advised me to read again this paper by Anna Zeidel in French, and I realized that she had the definition of the corpus which was very similar to the one which Anne Cheng later included in her famous book, Histoire de la pensée chinoise. And the highlighted items in yellow, that just show that when you begin to try to define this corpus, you end up doing the catalog. So it's like trying to define the Encyclopedia Universalis or Britannica. You end up saying, well, it's about history and geography and literature and this and that. So it's all patterns, which proves not that it is a big grab bag. that's what Anne Cheng wrote in his book. And another difference between the definitions is that we have two negative elements in the definition by Anne Cheng. First, it's a big grab bag, which actually is negative interpretation of the richness of the material. And also we have this pseudo-scientific data. Why pseudo-scientific? From which point of view? How do you define science? This opens a very wide array of questions. Of course, we have no time to deal on that. Just one point. The first definition was written by someone who, as most of you know, has been mainly involved in Taoist studies. And the second one by someone who has been mainly involved in Confucian studies. That's the story. A very brief history, so that people here not doing Chinese studies know what it's about. So we go back to 2,000 years ago almost, but those texts actually were fed by pre-imperial traditions from the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century before our era. But they blossomed just at the beginning of our era, around the year zero, if I may say so. There was an official edition sponsored by the emperor in 56 CE, much earlier than the standard edition of the classics was carved upon stone, which shows that they were pretty important at that time. Then we jump in time from the 3rd to the 14th century. We have repeated prohibitions, again, upon imperial order, and there was a reversal in the emperor's attitude towards this text, this corpus. And the reason for that was not because the contents was somehow hietao, perverse or unorthodox, but because they were assumed to be dangerous, because they could be used as tools for political propaganda, and they had been used as tools for political propaganda. Then much later again, we reached the Song Dynasty. There is this belief that there were most of these texts were lost at that time. And indeed, in the mid-14th century, official history of the Song Dynasty, in the treatise and bibliography, there is a single remaining group of West texts which is mentioned, and which is the group of texts related to the Book of the Changes, the I Ching. Now, the corpus we have today, since all those texts were believed to be lost, it's a collection of fragments, and they have been the collection has been edited. The fragments have been first collected by Yasui Kozan and Nakamura Shohachi, starting from the 50s or the 60s. They had this first edition collection of West writings, which was handwritten and mimeographed. Most libraries still have some of the volumes of this collection, and it's included, unfortunately, but expectedly perhaps, many errors in characters and punctuation. So what happened, they remade it the same, two scholars remade the edition. It was now typeset. They made corrections and they made additions to the original series of fragments. This is usually the critical edition which is used as basic text. And the third one is basically a Chinese re-edition of the corpus, using the second one as a basis and just making slight alterations here and there, moving a comma to another place and correcting a character. So actually, if you're interested in doing research on this text, you can use any of the second or third edition is perhaps more reliable. But I suspect they worked new mistakes in the text, because you cannot escape that. In this Japanese critical edition, we have 11 groups of West texts, and they are all related to famous texts, well-known besides, and including all the Confucian classics. Here I made an order according to the number of titles which we find in the Japanese critical edition. So there is river charts, and the duo read here are the name of two esoteric documents. And we've got the Spring and Autumn, which is a chronicle of the state of Lu, which was an ancient state during the pre-imperial era. 29 titles are attached to this Spring and Autumn chronicle. And then as we go down, we move through text, and we have less and less titles. And you can find all the new classics of early China, Book of Documents, Book of Rites, Book of Poetry, Music, the famous Confucius, even the classic of filial piety. And in all, we have 176 different titles, but these include variants, and some titles actually have a single fragment attached to them. So I think if we edit those fragments, see which one are more or less the same, we can probably cut the number of titles, perhaps by half, or who knows, I have really no idea. So the focus today is on one text which comes from the category which is highlighted in yellow there, the Spring and Autumn, so not the 29 titles, of course, but one of them. Here you have the title of this text in Chinese. I'm sorry for the people who cannot read Chinese. The pronunciation in modern standard Chinese, Tian Tan Pa. And as some of you already know, perhaps, discussing the meaning of the text, this corpus has all the texts they have in common, this same structure of the title. The first and second half. The first half usually is the main text, the standard text to which the West under consideration is attached, and the second half is the title of the West properly speaking. So here you can find in sources either Kuchu, Tianpanba, the five characters, or only the last three characters, but in practice there is no difference between both occurrences. So here in this case we have Kuchu, which is the name of the chronicle which I mentioned earlier. Sometimes you have a single character, like for the Book of Changes, usually it's just E, it's not E Jing, it's just that E. And then the second part here, which on which I will focus, for some minutes. We have usually three characters most of the time, but in some cases we have only two, and in some cases we have four. But most of the time it's three characters. So trying to understand what this title means, at first I was totally lost and I had no clue. I've been checking different secondary sources to see what people were writing about this. Simply speaking, the first and the second character may have the same meaning when they're objectival. They mean something which is deep, depth. Yeah. And when it's substantive, the second one more precisely means deep pool, or something very geographic, not exactly philosophical or whatever. And the first one has a verbal meaning, to be immersed, hidden, or latent. And the third one is the most problematic actually here, because it has lots of meaning in ancient Chinese. It is a place name of a very ancient state. It is the name of a mythical snake. And when it's an adjective, because of the shape, it came probably later at some point to mean crooked or not straight, bent somehow. So here is what two modern PhD dissertations come up with. The first one written by Toole in 1966, an American PhD, and it gives the handle for grasping the hidden and profound. I've highlighted the items, the three items. The red ones are the ones which, to me, are problematic. And more recently, Licia Di Giacinto, in her, also a PhD, which was turned into a book just a few months ago. I think I will read it very soon. She has proposed the hope, the hidden pool, which I think is perhaps even worse than Dürer's proposal. So I checked much earlier sources in order to see if during Chinese history at some point the meaning of this West had been analyzed or discussed, and I found quite late when you consider the time of production of the text, but still very early on, two different types of material explaining in two different ways what the text is supposed to be about in the light of the title, or the other way around, what means the title according to the contents of the text. Or I have deleted all Chinese text here, so the translation. Immersed in a deep pool evokes the depths of waterways and crooked their twists and turns. In Shu, Shu is the nameplace which is more or less exchangeable with Pa, the third character in the title. In Shu, rivers imitate the character for crooked as they flow, and the latter, this character for crooked, probably evokes their fondness. To compose such a title is bizarre to the extreme. And slightly later, although we don't have the exact dating, we have another discussion, its mechanism being difficult to fathom. It's a sort of verse, and its principle difficult to understand, obscure and steep, twisted like the character of a crooked, or twisted like a snake, perhaps. Next again comes the Qian Tan Pa. And the same author adds, the portents of yin and yang are unfathomable and known to none, and the suspension of disturbance in the heart of heaven is tortuous to maintain. So I think that those early explanations were much more closer to the meaning of the text than the tentative translations of the modern scholars. And so this is how I chose the title which I gave in the name of the paper. Very quickly now, the origin of the text. I'm not talking now, it's not the philological dating of the fragments themselves, it's the earliest mentions and citations of the text in translated sources, mostly. So the Japanese editors, they assumed that the earliest mention must be in the first item here on this slide, Comprehensive Discussions in the White Tiger Hall, which was supposedly made after a conference took place in 79 CE to discuss the meaning of the classics and of these West texts. And though this text has been ascribed to Bangu, who lived in the first century CE, modern scholars tend to date it to the mid-3rd century, so it cannot be the earliest mention. However, we have three different documents which are quoting entirely. We hope and believe that it's the original wording, and three responses to the throw, which are documents written by scholars when they are asked by the emperor to give advice on a certain topic. And in those three responses to the throne, one is dated 133, the other one 177 and 178, we have citations, quotations, clear quotations of the text under this title. So this proved that there was a text in the first or second century. by this title. So it goes back a very long way. The ownership now, very briefly again, it is unknown. There has never been any name attached to this title of WebText. Only once, the second item on the slide, in a quite late source, you'll see it's the early 18th century, we have this very, not this article, this very standard way of announcing the text. Usually you have the writer of the author first and then the title of the book. So this seems to mean that the Qiangtan Ba was written by this person, Jing Fang, who lived in the first century BCE, and who was very famous at that time, specialist of the Book of Changes. And this Jing Fang is not at all unknown, and 32 words, no less than that, were ascribed to him, but not a single Qiangtan Ba in the list. So it might be a mistake. Either it means that it has to be read like that, both that person and that text said, etc. Or it's simply a mistake when they a writer copies at some point inserted the title next to this person. But I wouldn't go as far as saying that the text was written by Jing Fang. In addition, we have authorship, not for the main or body of text, but for the fragments of commentaries, which are attached to the fragments of body text. And they are ascribed to this scholar here, Song Jun, from the 3rd century, who was a student of a well-known scholar to those of you who are involved in Chinese studies, Zheng Xuan, who wrote many, many commentary of things on Taoist classics, but also on Confucian classics, etc. And both persons, Song Jun and Zheng Xuan, they all have commentaries attached in the corpus that we have now. But this text, this one, we only have fragments ascribed to Song Jun, not to Zheng Xuan. Textual history, again, I cannot give too many details for fear that it will take too long. The first bibliographical mention, the first item here, dates from 677, and it's in the commentary of the dynastic history of the later Han, which was written by a crown prince of the Tang dynasty. Slightly later, 11th century, we have this very famous encyclopedia of the Taiping Qingguo era, read by the emperor in 1,000 chapters, a very big thing. And there is an appended list of work at the beginning of the work, actually, and it's the 98th item. So it was still extant, probably as an independent book, a physical book at that time. Then, 17th century, we move forward again. There is another book, known in English sometimes as General Bibliography of the Classics, the Jing Yitao. And the book is lost. It is said to be lost at this point. So it's not that the title doesn't appear in the book. It appears, but it's said to be lost. So it's known, but not to be extant anymore, so to say. And in the 18th century, 17th, in line, with other spring and autumn west, it is said to have not been transmitted for a long time. But then again, 19th century, what we have in the very late times, in Mark Wohan's work, which is known as the compilation of lost books, it appears again, and in one chapter. So it seems that the book somehow suddenly reappeared. So this mention in green doesn't refer to an independent book which was circulating again and which had been found by sort of miracle. It was probably saying that all the fragments and all the citations which had been collected and put together would amount in a chapter, and that was a part of a larger work, which were all collections of wet fragments. There were several collections of wet fragments in the later era. Now, we're going to deal with the slightly deeper in the text itself now. The reconstructed version, when I say reconstructed version, it's the version which comes from the Japanese critical edition. It appears in the volume 4, tome 2, etc. The page and those pages in the Chinese re-edition, which are more or less identical, apart from those slight changes, alterations, and corrections. And what we have is 232 fragments. Oh, you see? It begins from here, and each thing in yellow, each column is a fragment, and the one in orange are commentaries. So we have 232 different fragments, which are entirely
citations. There is nothing else. It's entirely a corpus of citations. And I call them item because it's shorter. And it means sexual item. So those items, the shortest one have five characters or words, as you, if you prefer, Chinese characters or Chinese words. And the longest one, there is a single one of these. Here it is. It is 329 on the left-hand half of the slide. 329 characters. And for most of the other, they have only one column of text. And the text begins with an example in five characters here. Tenzin, Tenzin, and the song of heaven has three treasures. And it goes on for 232 items, perhaps 20 pages or so. Alors, what are the sources now of the reconstructed version before we deal with the sequence of items in more detail? There is something very funny. They began working not with primary sources, but with what I call secondary sources.
You see, you've got four registers on the page. You've got the central register, which is the main text or body text. You've got collation notes, by example, this one. There's no.
Here we are. Okay.
Collation notes here on the upper margin. And on the lower margin, you have two registers again. The top half and the bottom half. In the bottom half, we have the secondary sources, which we use to build this reconstructed version. And then, in this upper half, we have the primary sources, which were used to collate the citations from the secondary sources. I would have gone the other way. I would have gone straight from the earlier sources and tried to gather as many as I can. But I didn't do like that.
So if you're interested in checking with more detail all the sources, you have the tables here. I made a separate handout of the tables which I appended to my draft. And the first table in this document is the list of all the secondary sources used. They are all late material, comparably late material. You see, they date mostly to the 19th and early 20th century. And they are all more or less collections of citations of earlier texts. It's mostly, you've got the figures in the, I think, in the right of each table, the number, and the dominating four or perhaps five sources, they all date to the 19th, 20th century. So actually, the Japanese scholars, the way they work is sort of traveling back in time. They took the material which was closest to them in time, which were these collections. They took out those series of citations which relates to each text, and then I went back to the earliest quotations in the earlier sources. And these earlier sources, they most of them, but not all of them, you can see in the table 2 in the handout. They are more numerous, for one thing, but in the case of our text, the concentration is around the 7th and the 8th century, which is still better than 19th and 20th century. But we don't have earlier quotations, apart from the two or the three which are quoted in the responses to the throne dated to the second century. Otherwise, it's all late sources. So I decided in my paper in this talk to call secondary sources collections and primary sources the sources which have the earliest versions of the citations, if I dare say so. Now, I will go back briefly. You see on top of each fragment in the reconstructed version, we have a sort of white dot or a circle which singles out every item. In some cases, we have this sort of X, not in X sign here. This is supposed to mean that this item is only a repetition of the one which precedes and should be dealt with in parallel with that one. And we have a much rarer occurrence, which is a triangle. And the triangle is supposed to, well, here we have a case on the right hand side.
This means that, according to the Japanese editors, this fragment comes after this one. So both should be read together, actually, which again can be discussed.
But the figures we have, it's mostly it's individual items. You see 280, and we have duplicates, only 12 of them. Actually, I found out that there are perhaps 20 or 30 more than those 12. And the follow-up cases, only two of them marked by the triangle. And as I have said earlier, we have two textual layers, main or body text and commentary. Oops, sorry. And example again here, for instance,
this is the commentary here, and it's set one character below the main text. This is the main text item, this is the commentary attached to this item. Again, here, main text, commentary attached to this item. This is how the text works in this modern edition.
So now we can enter the text. So what I did is, from the first item put by the Japanese scholars at the head of the text to the very last one, I simply made a very simple definition or description of what it's about. And in some cases we have series, like for instance the first 7-1, more or less give you the same theme, but in many cases you see it's
isolated item which have nothing to do with the one before or the one after. In some cases we have series, and we have a very long series, there are
the 60 days of the sexagesimal cycle. They have one prediction or prognostication on for an eclipse on each of the 60 days. Well, that's the longer series actually. So we have definitions. Some fragments just define the meaning, give the meaning, or discuss perhaps the meaning of special isolated characters. Then we have what is dominating actually is phenomenal isolation, like fire springing out of the well.
So this will be
observed, noted down, and they will propose an extrapolation on that. We have lots of astronomy and meteorology in the reconstructed text. We also have cases of abnormality like the palace noises. That's very interesting. If there is a crack in the pillars or
in the Buddha structure of the palace,
it can mean all sorts of things. Palace tiles again. If a tile flies away or falls by itself, it means something. The solar eclipses I mentioned. We have actually 62 items because we have two repetitions in them. Lots of solar eclipses. Then, in a very limited number of cases, you have nomenclature.
They give you correspondences and how to name things. And here, it's very funny because it's the nomenclature of Phoenix calls. And I thought at first that each name of each call had a meaning, but actually it seems to be a sound word. It's really funny. Another abnormal instance is gender change. It's not animals, it's human beings. In this table, also, I have noted the duplicates, those who seem to be fragments, seem to be identical to one another. These, when it's marked duplicates, it was found by the Japanese editors. And when it's undetected duplicates, like here, when I worked with the text, I realized that there are many cases where items were obviously variants of one another and they should be dealt with together. So we have lots of undetected duplicates, perhaps between, like I said, 20 and 30 in the text. Gender change again comes back slightly later. Why not put them together? Two suns rising, we have very weird things. Again, solar eclipses, meteoric showers, lunar phenomena. There is the rising of 10 moons at the same time. I wonder if it's not a mistaken character. We also have people's behavior being taken into account, like people entering the palace. The palace with a capital P is where the emperor resides, so it's very important. The setting, it's important to know what's happening there. So people entering the palace. Again, we have a fragment of system, the relationship between the five flavors and the five viscera, which are, of course, an application of the five-agent system. Again, abnormalities like the birth of a five-headed human being. Weapons and imperial bells. The phenomena observed. The bells began to sound by themselves, and weapons fly by themselves. For example, because it's not arrow, they say weapon, swords. And, it's all unusual instances or cases of abnormal instances or imperial horses, again, behavior of the personal horses used by the emperor may mean something political very important. We have Palestine and Palace Noise, which come back again. Horse in the Palace, again, Solar and United States again. Number two of on 97, page 97, absence, the absence of fish in water. That's interesting because it's a sort of negative evidence somehow. And indeed, we end with human physical features. Very, I could have highlighted this one, very weird thing talks about. First, people having red hair, okay, but then people having blood on their clothes and hair growing under the sole of the shoes. So very weird.
The mighty religious character.
Anyway, so. Yeah, that's a big blunt, right? It doesn't tell much. We don't know if it's sometimes it's the absurd phenomena, which I pointed out sometimes seems to be the theme. And as I said, some items seem to describe things, others seem to make actual prognostics and divination or something. So I've been reading lots of this sort of stuff in the past years. And I have defined a sort of typology of the fragments we find in the reconstructed text and in other texts in the same critical edition. But I want to focus now on the item morphology, which is the most common in this text. I think it's perhaps 60%. And it's an item which extrapolates various types of data from the observation of phenomena. So it's binary, it's sort of binary structure. It's a statement, actually, made of two elements. We have a premise, for instance, 10 suns arise, or something like that. And then we have second half, a conclusion, something will happen, whatever. Or perhaps something is already happening. We'll be discussing this in a moment. So the model is, if X, then Y. And this has different name according to the field in propositional logic. I don't know if some of you have comments to make about that. It is called the rule of detachment, modus ponens or modus ponendi ponens, the way that a theme is by a theme. In grammar, it's a conditional sentence of the implicative type. And Joachim Gentz, in a talk he gave a few months ago, Divination and Canon Exegesis in Avicenna and the Near East, reminded us that people doing Assyriology, research in Assyriology, they use two Greek words, protasis and apodosis, which actually come from ancient Greek grammar and mean, just like in the grammar I said above. In a conditional sentence, protasis is the dependent clause or the condition, the element X, and the apodosis is the main clause or the consequence, the element Y. So we're going to now read a few examples. I'm sorry, not in Chinese. First, examples of the basic morphology and then variants, because the basic example can become much more complex. So here is one pretty straightforward. I think it has only 5 characters. It's one of the shortest. And I try not to have too many words that keep the rhythm of the Chinese text. Earthquake, which is the premise, and then we have the conclusion. Inferiors conspire against their superior, sometimes meaning the angle. So we have a phenomenon, an earthquake, and we have an extrapolation. This conspires. Number 864 actually is a variant of the former one, although it's not isolated as being a variant. It's said to be a variant of the former one. There's only 2 changes of characters, and Earth moves and shakes. Ministers and inferiors conspire against the emperor. Same structure and almost same content. Now we have another example. It gets funnier as we go on. Here we have 2 premises and 3 conclusions. And we find the horse, which we just saw a moment ago in the list, in the sequence. The horse has walked into the palace. This is the premise. Conclusion, a grand minister is not loyal and does not behave compliantly. Then we have X prime. We have a second premise. The horse has emitted a cry and left. Then we have an addition of 2 conclusions, Y prime, Y second. First, the minister is renowned in the realm, probably the one who appears in the first conclusion, and then the orders of the ruler are not carried out. So, very interesting, but is there any relationship with the theme of the KGF research? So, are we dealing with prognostication, knowing in advance? What is the diachronic relationship between the observed phenomenon and the extrapolated data, to say it simply? So, we have a few examples here, and what is highlighted in red is time-related words, which may give us a clue to the question I just asked. So this one is a basic repetition of the basic model, two premises and two conclusions, a major snowing, a huge snowing, very thick. The conclusion is afterwards, so here we know that it's not simultaneous, there must be a woman ruling, which in China is catastrophe. Never put a woman in power. I'm sorry, but it's true. And the second model, we have the second premise, the sky snows for consecutive months. Now we have a lens, which have been added to the premise itself. And the conclusion is yin is manifesting its power, or yin yang here. I'm not going to teach, to give a lecture about yin yang. It's a sort of basic dualistic system, which is common to all Chinese thinkers, basically, from very early on. And yin, of course, goes to those of you who have made some research on the topic with everything which is darkness, water, femininity, evil, loneliness, etc. So, of course, you know, when it's snowing, it's the agent of water, and it's cold, and it's dark, and it's yin. And manifesting its power, there is no surprise in that. I wonder really why they needed to give this instance here. It's almost obvious. Anyway, another example now. We have a single premise, but three different conclusions. And again, we have a few time-related words. So, the observed phenomenon is a solar eclipse on the Guimao day, which is the day number 40 in the 60-day cycle. Solar eclipse on the 40th day of the cycle. So we have a date. Precise date. And the three conclusions, the first one, the feudatories disapproving the Son of Heaven do not obey him. Second one, the excellency over the masses, which is the name of a high-ranking dignitary, brings about the fall of the state, so negative. And the third conclusion, afterwards, again we have a time-related word, which brings even further away this conclusion, there will be a major insect plague, of course, which was to be feared in a certain agrarian empire. The third example with time-related words, and it follows the basic structure, very simple. A solar eclipse on another day of the 60-day cycle, on the 13th day, the Bingzi day, and the extrapolated data is there will be, it's implied, a major frosting on the fifth month. But here again, if the Bingzi day occurs during this month. So, will the frosting occur on the same month or on the fifth month in the following year? But there can be a few days difference, a few days gap between the observation and the announcement, if you want. But there can be also up to 13 months almost delay between the observed phenomenon and the consequence. So, I think this asks very interesting questions. Now, just for fun, it's an example of a much more complex item than those we have surveyed now. So I've deleted all X and Ys. We just go with the time-related words highlighted in red. It's about stellar phenomena. The Eastern Whale constellation rules over the 6 months. It seems to be an introduction to tell you what time we're going to talk about, but it's not sure, that's why you have the square brackets. If at that time, that's my understanding, but I might be wrong. The color of the sun is colored red, and like reddening for more than a decade or a fortnight, so we have duration now. On the first day of the 12th month, so now we have again a date, there will be a solar eclipse. The four quadrants, which means the entire realm, will aim at the ruler, and the military high officer will subdue the army. Very dangerous after. Afterwards, again, a time word, the empire will be in great disorder, which has, for centuries been the nightmare in Chinese context. It's all in the empire. For 90 days, so we have 3 months of focus going on. And again, further away on the forthcoming 6 months, which is next year, heaven will emit a sound and earth will split open. The three excellencies and the nine chamberlains, again high dignitaries in Imperial China, will all rebel. Each one of them will establish himself as lord, and the victor will claim kingship. But this will not be the mandate of heaven. So this means that all this negative thing is not the will of heaven, it's against heaven's will, actually, which is also very Chinese in a way. So this is not the longest item, it's one of the longest, but not the 329 character one. So this structure, I've been giving you examples, these predictive items. We have 188 of them within the 232, so it's a huge majority. I call them extrapolative because they extrapolate data from observation. But we have other kinds of material, for instance, speculative. And here we have an example which I translated. This is the one which brings together the five flavors and the five viscera. The five flavors generate the five viscera. Saltiness generates the liver, soreness the heart, bitterness the spleen, sweetness the lungs, and pungency the kidneys. There is absolutely no thing here related to prognostication or whatever. It's just describing a system which is in the background of all of this. Then we have C and D more or less work together, although the target is not exactly the same. Admonitory, telling what someone should not do. And usually the person who is the target of the admonition is clearly mentioned here. It is the emperor himself, the son of heaven. The son of heaven should not dig the earth deeply. Digging deeply would entail suffering for the people, the overturning and sinking down of cities. A bit weird, perhaps, but clearly in the logic of the thing. And the other side of the admonition might be a prescription. It's not what not to do, but what to do now. And sometimes here we have the target person, but here we don't have it. Water flowing counterstream is contrary to nature. Of course, fanmi, contrary to nature, also means that perhaps the ruling mandate of the emperor is menaced, because it's exactly the same wording, fanmi. So, of course, what should one do? It is appropriate, and the prescription begins here, to cultivate virtue, a very classic way to heal such problems, as a response to this. But here we don't have the target, but we can guess that it must be someone very high position, probably the emperor himself as well. And we have a fifth type of items, but we have a single example in the 232 fragments I've been talking about. And I translated here, I'm not even sure of the meaning, when Emperor Zhang, which is correlated to the east, began to rise, the northern dipper pointed to Yin. Northern dipper is the great bear in Western astronomy. And Yin means the east-northeast, and this the direction corresponding to the first month of the year. And the quintessential luminous looked up in awe. Not necessarily narrative, it could be of the speculative genre, perhaps. But it's not very important, because in this text it's very not represented at all. I've been working on another series of fragments. The paper will be published next year, I think. And this category is the dominating one. It's all about mythology and interpretations of mythology to tell things about politics and the legitimacy of power and such issues. But here it's not the case at all. This text is mostly concerned with extrapolations, so I think it's pretty much within the frame of the KGF project. But again, I don't know if we go back to this example, for instance, the very first one. Yes. So, are we to understand that the conspiration is already going on, or are we to understand that there will be a conspiration at some future point in time? I mean, it's very important. So we don't have the key here. So I always wonder if it's about actually divining the future, or if it's about becoming aware of something which you would never hear about, or at least not immediately. It's a sort of accelerating the knowledge or the circulation of information somehow. Because when we have those highlighted in red time-related words, it's clear, it's afterwards. But when we don't, so here I'm translating the second example.
a grand minister is not loyal and does not behave compliantly because I don't have a Chinese word, meaning specifically that it will happen in the future. But it could be a grand minister will be not loyal and will not behave compliantly. And then the minister will be renowned in the realm and the orders of the rulers will not be carried out. It's impossible to say when you don't have, because those of you who do Chinese studies know that the grammar and the syntax is very simple, and there are many words used to indicate the tense, past or future, but they are omitted sometimes because they think that the meaning is clear enough by itself. So it's very hard to say. The fact that in some cases we have time-related words would perhaps seem to suggest that if they're not there, perhaps it's already happening, so it's not exactly prognostication in the future. It's rather telling you what's already happening. It's a sort of way to get information with sort of internet, perhaps. Or a great line. Because in the mind of classical China, the emperor is always isolated in the capital. He has no information from outside. He's surrounded by his clan and by the government, and who deal with the concrete matters here and now. So he never knows what's happening anywhere. So it might be a good way for him to bypass all these people surrounding him and trying to get other sources of information, knowing what's happening, the feudataries, his own family, the other princes, etc. So it might be an interesting angle to pursue further on. Interestingly, these five types of items which I pointed to you, they almost never happen by themselves, only in very simple fragments. When the fragments get longer, you have at least two different genres, if you want. Example here, a combination of extrapolation and speculation. There is an ox moaning in the palace. Here we have the classic example of the phenomenon observed, and then the extrapolation. Political and moral authority are declining. The feudataries are getting together again, in the future or in the present tense. You can decide by yourself. And then we have a sort of commentary, but which is not in the commentary. Oxen symbolize troops, because it's about an ox moaning in the palace. And then in the commentary D, by Song Jun, I think, we have when two oxen tangle horns, one ox must be harmed. Feudataries getting together are like oxen tangling horns. So perhaps the element which I cite B in the translation was originally part of a commentary which has somehow been mixed with the main text, but perhaps it was also originally in the main text. The second example in the middle of the slides, a blend of extrapolation and admonition. So it begins with an admonition. If you read it in a certain way, when the Son of Heaven spreads embroideries, I'm not sure what it means, over the earth, perhaps is being too generous. The earth must move to the point of provoking an earthquake. And the Son of Heaven will die without hair. So it ends like an extrapolation of the earthquake, but it begins as a warning to the Son of Heaven, do not spread embroidery, whatever this means. A third example of combined items. It begins as a sort of speculation, like defining words. They like to define words in this corpus of worth or apocryphal corpus. Eclipse means to blame, but this begins as a definition of the word. And then we have a prescription. Generally, in case of solar or lunar eclipse, the lord of men, which means the emperor, must reproach his own person so as to alarm himself. So then a prescription, what to do. And here again we have the target is named the emperor himself. And a much longer example, which has combined at least, perhaps even more, three different genres. We have extrapolation, speculation, and admonition. It begins with the admonitory type. If those who constitute the ruling house deregulate the five agents and denature the five constants, then, between brackets, I could say, the quelling star will be set into motion. This is the conclusion. And the earth will shake. So this is a warning not to do that. So to me, it belongs to C. It's all tentative anyway. Then we have, when the earth shakes, we are back to extrapolation. The yin category responds to it, because in the classic Chinese mind, heaven is yang and earth is yin. Heaven is positive, light, etc. And earth is yin, negative, femininity, etc. Human hearts are frightened, which makes invaders arrive, ministers be despotic, and women arrogant. Well, this element A here is clearly an extrapolation on the earthquake. And then we have a sort of commentary, what I call speculation. Such calamities are major losses which worry the god of the soil and the god of grain, which were two important divinities in early China. So like I said, we have in this text, in this particular text, a clear domination of the extrapolative genre, which concerns 188 items out of 272. And if you take a look at your handout on the table, the third table, which occupies all the page, you have put all together the 188 different phenomena which are used as basis for extrapolation. They're all there. And I organize the table so as to have a decreasing order. So it begins with the dominating theme. So you can see that I brought together what I call uranology, which is the science of the heavens, if you will. And in this group, we have 119 of the out of the 188. It's the overwhelming dominating group. And within this, we have a subgroup, astronomy, which in itself has already 101 of the 188 elements. And the observed phenomena, which comes first from far away, is solar eclipse. We have many, many of them. And the subgroup, the secondary subgroup in this group, is meteorology, which is already far behind because we have only 18 such instances. And classically, we have the rainbow, the mist, wind and the color of the sky, thunderbolt, etc. So if indeed the sciences of the heavens is the dominating group, we also have the sciences of the earth, geology, but it's far behind. It's only 27 items out of 188. And in it we have seismology. I use these modern words, I mean, just a way to bring the table together. It doesn't mean anything from the point of view of the history of science. No implication at all, just to make the table clearer. Seismology, everything which is related to the earth moving or behaving weirdly, like opening up faults, landslides, mountain formation, mountain rockfall, earth shining or giving away a light or a sound, earthquake, of course. And we have a weird instance of earth vomiting blood. Not sure what it means. And two subcategories, but now which really come to very low figures, and six items and two items, which I call hydrology, concerning the water flow, backwards, and geography, with a very weird instance of hairy earth. Not sure what it means. Erected stone, we heard of that when David Zenal made a reading session of chapter 6. Of the Sochenti a few months ago. And I think there are connections between the weft corpus and the development of this genre, which is known in Chinese as Zhuguai, which means weird things and anomalies and deviant things, something like that. In the third group, which I call again sociology, without meaning any. I don't want people who do anthropology to believe that I put them under the subheading of sociology. It's just a way to describe it simply in a very rough way what it's about. Material culture, only 17 items concerning the palace, the well, altars of the soil god, and like I said, clothing in some cases, bells, weaponry. And anthropology is mostly, but again, it's very low figure, only 7 items. People's behavior, gender change, which is always interesting in very ancient society. The appearance of a saint, very important probably, and an abnormal birth. And the last, fourth and last group deals with animals, or here again, more for fun than for a real purpose. I've chosen these words, mammalogy and mammals, if you prefer. Entomology deals with insects, ophiology with scaly animals, and ichthyology, fish, a single case. So clearly the observed phenomenology is overwhelmingly dominated by astronomy and, in a way, all the phenomena which can be observed in the heavens. Now, the extrapolation is the second item here on the slide. Things get a bit more complicated because in the first category we have one single phenomenon for each single fragment, but here we have, on average, 2.4 extrapolations. heavy corpus to deal with. So it takes quite a few pages in the handout. And it's subdivided into table 4 to 1, 1 to 8. And I think it covers like 3 pages. Again, I have used descending order just to give you an idea of the themes which dominate in that second typology. So now we're not dealing anymore with the observed phenomena, it's what is extrapolated. And I was not really surprised. The dominating group is what I call dynastic affairs. It's the ruler himself, overwhelming. 59, although it's equivalent to the officials in the second table. And if we bring in this group of dynastic affairs, the ruler and with the other women around him, not making distinctions between the different ranks, like spouses or the empress herself or the empress mother in some cases. I just use the generic word woman. Relatives of the emperor and the palace, which is the place where the emperor is supposed to reside. This is the dominating group. Here the domination is not as obvious as it was in the case of the observed phenomena, because the second ensemble, which I call governance, it's all about the officials and hierarchy and morality as well, is almost equivalent, 94, 91, and the number of items concerned, 60 and 62, is almost equivalent. And in this second group, it's the officials, which are the dominating team. It's very interesting because if you, without even moving to the to the next pages, you perhaps realize that you have three items with an asterisk in front of them on the last, at the top of the ruler block, and then we have two items also with an asterisk at the bottom, the ruler block, and two more at the bottom of the officials block in the second half of the table. Those are positive extrapolations, meaning that all the rest is pejorative, and you just need to read. It's all disasters, misbehavior. It's a picture by Jerome Bosch. Yeah, the ruler can die, be killed, has to flee, he's afraid, he's in peril, he's powerless, he's deposed, he's being suspicious, he behaves in an immoral way, he's incapable, he's debauched, he has no troops, he's tied up, inconstant, alone, playful, he doesn't care for politics, he's not buried, this is for after his death, of course, he has no hair, and there is a vacancy of the position, etc. The only three positive extrapolations. He might be renaissance in a way, bring them to the upper level of what it is, what it means, and what the function of being an emperor means. Or he might cultivate virtue at some point. And in one case, he's told that to be perfect, at least a very positive side. And the official is the same. The picture of the official is really awful. I think it tells a lot of the Chinese experience at that time of their own administration. The officials can take or hold power, they can plot, they can deceive, they can be wicked, tyrannical, they can compete with one another, they can rebel, be inefficient, of course, they can foster disorder, they can flee, depose the ruler, disobey, etc. And the only two positive facets for these officials is being efficient, which happens once, so they are not all inefficient, and they might be good-hearted. Also a very minority thing. Hierarchy here is very important because you see no authority in the first item, in the hierarchy subcategory, still in the second block. It's quite well represented. And usually what happens is that there's a reversal. Those guys, the low guys, the scoundrels, they are in power, they are in charge, while the good-hearted and the worsies are expelled from power and have to leave the court. But it's a reversal of the hierarchy. So if we turn the page to the third block of extrapolations, there is a group I've called World Affairs, and it's mostly about the people, but here the differences in numbers are not that big. I have subcategories like people, the feudatories, territories, the realm, and again the saint. And
among the only three positive items here, we have the realm being at peace, which appears once, the saint appearing, which also appears once, three or four times, and the saint in some cases receiving the mandate, which is very important, because if the saint receives the mandate, it means that the emperor, the current emperor, will simply leave his job and give it to this saintly person. So that means a change of probably of dynastic legitimacy. Quite important, but not very well represented. Then there is also a very a group of main importance military affairs, never far away in the Chinese mind. So we have war and armies maneuvering around or being disordered and whatever. Mention of enemies who are either invaders, barbarians, and once brigands. Generals misbehaving, killing one another, or revolting, or subduing the army, or trying to usurp the throne. And soldiers, with again two positive images of the Minsk. Now, these four first categories I call human agency, because the extrapolation always concerns directly people, what they are going to do, what will be their fate, this sort of issue. And the table is not over, we have the third page, and here we have minority groups. And it's the non-human agency. So what is funny is that you immediately see uranology, but we have this in the first table, yes, which means that you can have celestial phenomena as an observed thing, and you can also have celestial phenomena as an extrapolated data, something which will happen, which is already happening. And we have many elements, of course, in common with the first table, but also a few original ones. And astronomy here comes second, just behind meteorology. And then, very briefly, the last three groups. Number six, we have geology, with the same subgroups as we had in the first table, but now being the target data, extrapolated. What I call cosmology, it's talking about the yin yang or omens, which are not very precise, precisely described, and the five agents. And the last one is again animals. And here we have more or less the same animals, but so very low figures, only 10 items here, coming 9. So now, perhaps we can turn to the last table just for a few minutes, and I will end up here, probably. I've tried to put together these two tables, which means that I have taken into consideration on one side of the table the 188 phenomena, and on the other side of the table the 457 operations. So naturally, I could not write as detailed as it is in the preceding table. So I just used the number of occurrences, just for us to have a figure of how do these two series, on the one hand the observed phenomena, on the other hand the extrapolated data, how do they work together? So it's plain and simple. The only column almost which has figures everywhere, and quite high figures, it's astronomy. It concerns basically almost all the extrapolated domains. And if we define couples in green, the observed phenomena in blue, the extrapolated data, the dominating couple, they all have astronomy in the green element. So the dominating couple, if you want, or dominating correlation is observing something as a group and talking about the group again, or making a group of predictions on something. And then it's always astronomy and something else, the officials. And astronomy, which is very scientific, when you want to know what's happening in the stars, in the modern era, you're not going to take a look at the grass, or you're going to take a look at the sky. So this is sort of quite to the modern mind, the expression. And astronomy meteorology, which was also in the West, a natural correlation in the classic times, people, women, and warfare. But this would probably take much longer time to make an in-depth analysis of how those two series correlate, because it's really huge numbers. I think the table says it with its figures. Or if I have a couple of minutes, I can add a few concluding remarks. I use the expression of diachronic process concerning here the items which deal with prognostication, for instance, if we can call this, or extrapolation, like I said. We have an item 75.2 which talks specifically about this diachronic process, which is interestingly it's triggered, entirely triggered by human agency. And based on the definition of two different words. The first is the definition of the word calamity. Calamity means an injury, a punishment, death following facts. And then the second half of the item is anomaly means strangeness, a foreboding. What is interesting is that the elements highlighted in red here, these following facts, it means that it comes after, and it's sui in Chinese, and here the foreboding, the part of the word which is translated as foreboding is xian, comes before. So we have the basic idea behind the text and the way the extrapolations are constructed is that you first have human behavior, which is bad, which gives birth to a calamity as a consequence. But before the calamity appears, there is an anomaly which tells you in advance, which warns you that there is going to be a calamity. It's sort of these three elements. And the diachronic process, and actually all the items as work like this 188 items, more or less, they all basic logic. Another question I think it would be interesting to further research is, do we have here an empiric process, or is it a systematic method? Because most of the items do not seem to cover all the possibilities. Some, if you draw a chart, for instance, we have lots of blanks. But in some cases, we seem to have sort of systematic code, like the 60 days of the cycle, we have extrapolations for eclipses on all these days. This is clearly a systematic code.
And another example here, we have X premise and non-X, the opposite. This is all designed to cover all the possibilities. You either have the white fox which arrives, or you don't. And you can extrapolate in both cases. I think this is very systematic.
And the last point, I just talk about that very briefly in the conclusion of the draft paper. It's the sources and the influence. The sources, we have to work on pre-imperial texts to find where the West authors drew inspiration from. And probably the Lu Chronicle itself. Because in two cases I found that we have observation of the solar eclipse, and the extrapolation in this text corresponds to what happens in the Chunqiu. But only twice in the 60-day cycle. So it was not the only source.
And the influence, like I said, on the Gregorian journal, for instance, and the development of other
techniques of prognostications, and the relationship with the Zheshu, of course, on which Kalinowski, the same first letter, Kalinowski and Harper are working, the Zheshu, and all this. I think I'm done. Thank you.